Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It may be 6 months until the 2010 election, and certainly 6 months is at least six lifetimes in politics, but the race for Massachusetts governor is already heating up, and it's a surprisingly close race between the top three contenders. So that, and a weak economy, and the lingering aftershocks of Senator Scott Brown's January win, well, all that made us think that it's never too soon to get to know those who would occupy the governor's office. So today we kick off the first in our series of conversations with the gubernatorial candidates, and we start with Republican Charlie Baker. Here's Baker announcing his candidacy at Faneuil Hall in January.
I know a lot about state government. I know what it looks like when it's working, and I know what it looks like when it's not. And right now, under this administration, state government is most definitely not working.
Well, Charlie Baker joins us. Welcome to Radio Boston.
How are you?
I'm doing
happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. Let me just start off by asking you about the Baker's Dozen of budget proposals that you released last week. The one that seemed to get the most attention right off the bat there was the proposal that said that you would require people to produce some form of ID or residency proof in order to apply for state services. That obviously produced a lot of ire among certain groups.
My stance is that I was basically referencing the Perry Amendment, which was debated during the House budget debate and was sent to a study committee, I think, for the second or third year in a row by an 82-75 vote, which is a pretty close vote, clearly indicating that there were a lot of people who were interested in seeing this idea move forward. The Perry Amendment basically would require some affirmative process for determining citizenship for folks accessing state services, state paid for state services and benefits. And there are exemptions in there for kids and exemptions in there for emergency services. I think it's something that's important for state government from a credibility point of view. I think, as I said that day, I think it's I don't think it's appropriate for people who are citizens of Massachusetts to be waiting in line when folks who aren't citizens of Massachusetts access benefits. And this would be a pretty easy way. And you don't have to pick all services at once. You could pick one, two, or three services and start there and treat it as a demonstration. But, I mean, this is an idea that's been around now for two or three years. It keeps getting kicked to study. Nobody does the study. At a minimum, I think we ought to try it and just see what comes of it.
Mm-hmm. And obviously the reason why this really rankled some people is because it just came right on the heels of the Arizona law passing that would require people to basically carry some form of citizenship or residency identification at all times. And also now in the city of Boston, there's this move to perhaps, you know, divest some business that the city might do with Arizona. So as governor, is that something that you would support, that Massachusetts should not do business with a state with Arizona?
I think Arizona is obviously not Massachusetts. Massachusetts isn't Arizona. Arizona is a border state. They have very different issues than Massachusetts has. I think what Massachusetts should do is pursue something like the Perry Amendment, which in my mind is a nice way of or an appropriate way of dealing with what's mostly on people's minds these days, which is appropriate and efficient use of state tax dollars. And I think from Arizona's point of view, and maybe from Massachusetts as well, the big issue is the lack of any kind of federal leadership around this whole question of immigration.
Mm-hmm. So overall, in your budget proposal, the 13 points that you had, you said that it would, you estimated that it would save roughly $1 billion. It would save the state $1 billion.
Right.
Other estimates coming out of the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, for example, kind of put the number at half that. Roughly $500 to $600 million. So where are you saying that we could achieve savings that these outside observers saying we can't?
Well, I guess what I would say is $500 or $600 million is still a really big number for a state that has a $2 billion structural deficit. I think I'm not familiar with what the Mass Taxpayers Foundation said. What I would say is those are 13 items. You know, I can come up with 15, 20, 30, 40 more. The bottom line here is the current folks on Beacon Hill are leaving a very big deficit for whomever the next governor is. That governor is going to have to dig the state out of it. And I wish the state of Massachusetts right now, under the current leadership, was pursuing a lot of these reforms so that they would start to become enacted and effective right away so that we could start chipping away at what everybody acknowledges is going to be a really big structural deficit, maybe as much as $2 billion faced by the next governor.
Mm-hmm. Well, the current leadership on Beacon Hill, as you refer to, is of course Governor Patrick, and he would say
and
that...
Treasurer Cahill.
And Treasurer Cahill. Governor Patrick, at least, has definitely said that in part he inherited the circumstances that led to this structural deficit, that it's not, you know, his bad leadership that's caused this financial crisis for the state.
Yeah, and what I would say to that is on Governor Patrick's first day in office, he reinstated about $383 million worth of spending that had been vetoed out by the previous governor, and he ended the year with a $300 million budget deficit. So from where I sit, he inherited...
But he also had tax receipts that eventually went down as the financial crisis
continued. But he raised spending by 20% his first 2 years in office. He spent money out of the rainy day fund before it started to rain. There was nothing wrong with tax revenues coming in those first couple years he was in office. He spent $300 million more than he took in his first year. He spent $500 million more than he took in his second year. I think in some respects the fiscal crisis was the fiscal crisis, but we should not forget that the state had more than a $2 billion rainy day fund. There was billions of dollars in stimulus money that came to the state of Massachusetts, and right now the state of Massachusetts, despite all that support from the rainy day fund and from the federal government, is going to be looking at a big structural deficit coming out the other end. And right now, over the course of the last couple of years, we should have been pursuing reforms and savings initiatives so that once all that one-time money runs out, we'd be in a position to live with whatever that new normal looks like.
Regarding that structural deficit, if you were to be elected governor, $2 billion is quite a bit. So how would you actually, fill that gap?
Well, start with my baker's dozen, which is 13.
But that's
13 ideas. We have many more. Pension reform is, we should be pursuing pension reform, period. Aggressively pursuing it because no one thinks the current system is sustainable. No one thinks it's affordable. And in addition to that, there are a lot of taxpayers who believe that there's sort of two sets of rules on this one. You know, they live with one set of rules. They pay taxes, and state government lives by another set of rules. State government shouldn't have a different set of rules.
What would you do that's different that would actually overcome, for example, union resistance to some of these reforms?
Well, I think on the pension thing, we made a proposal, Richard Tessier and I did last fall. Everybody had said, hey, the state's done pension reform. I think before that, I think the state did modest pension reform. They basically took some of the really awful and most egregious examples of abuse of the system off the table. But in terms of creating a system that was affordable on a go-forward basis for the taxpayers and the people of Massachusetts, we hadn't done that yet. I think one of the problems we face right now is we're not making the hard structural decisions we need to make to send the message to people in Massachusetts that we are going to get out of this jam, we are going to put the budget behind us, and we'll get serious about reforming state government. I mean, let's face it, most people out there know that the news coming out of Beacon Hill for the last couple of years is, you know, constantly in flux and usually ends up being bad, and many people are worried that it's going to be bad going forward. And when you got the Boston Globe writing Sunday editorials about the fact that the leadership on Beacon Hill is just kicking the can ahead with regard to dealing with the state's fiscal crisis, they're not taking on the serious issues associated with reform, and they're going to leave for the next administration, whoever that happens to be, a big, gigantic structural deficit. I mean, people pay attention to that stuff, and it sends the wrong message about whether state government's serious about getting its act together.
Well, I think part of the reason why they're paying attention is because the reality of many individuals' lives is equally bad. I mean, everyone's got huge economic concerns. If they haven't already lost their job, they're worried
about doing so, and costs
keep going up. And another area we've got quite a bit of expertise, and I'd like to dive into that. And that is, you know, the world of healthcare, and it's such a big issue here in Massachusetts.
I've been saying for 5 years that one of the biggest problems we face in healthcare is the fact that there's no publicly available information on what anybody charges for services. And I advocated aggressively for the state to move in that direction. Jim Roosevelt, who's a Democrat, and I made a whole series of reform proposals in 2007 with regard to things we thought the state could do to reduce the cost of healthcare, most of which fell on deaf ears and nobody did anything about. And I also made a series of recommendations as a member of the Governor's Healthcare Quality and Cost Council, some of which were not recommendations I agreed with, but I basically said at the time, doing almost anything in this space is better than doing nothing, and nothing happened with regard to those as well. So I'm thrilled the governor's finally discovered the healthcare issue, but there are a lot of people out there who've been banging away on the fact that we need to do something about the cost of health care for a long time. And I wish he'd engaged on this question a lot sooner.
And I believe that one of the you mentioned the Health Care Quality and Cost Council. I believe one of the recommendations that did come out of that was the government looking into some form of
There were 12 recommendations
some
on
form
that.
Of
and
regulation.
I voted for it because I didn't want to lose any of the other ones as part of the conversation.
Well, let me ask you about another recommendation that came out of that council, which is looking more aggressively at this idea of global payments. So and that's, of course, a totally different model of how we pay for health care. Would you then, am I hearing you say that you would be willing as governor, for example, to sit down at a table with your former colleagues at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, with your former people you know at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, with the folks from Partners, for example, and say, look, we've all got to work together. Why don't you accept some
form? Why don't we start with public disclosure? Why don't we start with putting all the data associated with what people get paid and how they perform into the public domain and let the public into this conversation? Why is it whenever we talk about this, it's always got to be some small group of bureaucracies, public or private, negotiating behind some curtain with one another?
Oh, I think this conversation could absolutely happen in public.
Look, I think, you know, for a long time, I've been saying, put this data into the public domain, let people see it, let's engage on it, let policymakers see it, let patients see it, let providers see it. And let's create some urgency and some focus on this issue.
But
for 5 years, nobody's done anything on this.
Transparency in the data is one thing, but I don't know how many people say that that is the single most effective solution to controlling long-term costs, which are accelerating beyond the rate of inflation. There's no doubt about that.
No, that's why I've been talking about it.
So would you? So that's why I'm asking my question. Would you, in an open forum, absolutely do it in public, but would you be willing to sit down with the major players of healthcare in the state and say, accept global payments because that may be an effective way to control costs?
But then you have to get into the conversation about whether or not global payments are the solution. Now, right now in Massachusetts, all right, there are many provider organizations out there who deliver a very high quality product for about 35 or 40% of what other people perform at. It's got nothing to do with the way they get paid from a global payment versus a fee-for-service versus whatever else. Some of the highest paid providers in Massachusetts operate in a global payment system right now. I don't think it's so much about payment. I think it's about getting serious about giving the people who are doing a really good job for a reasonable price credit and the ability to brag and promote that and for us to all encourage more of that. And we haven't been doing that for the past 4 or 5 years.
Well, and back in 2006, you did contemplate temporarily a run for governor, and you decided not to. So what's the difference 4 years later?
My kids are older. That's a big part of it. My oldest is now a freshman in college. The other two are in high school and middle school. I've always viewed this as incredibly disruptive to my family and never really wanted to put them in a crummy spot. But the big issue for me was I'm just completely dismayed by the way the state's handled the current fiscal crisis, and I think I could bring a lot to the table, having been part of two turnarounds, one in the early 90s in the Weld administration and one at Harvard Pilgrim, at a point in time when the state faces really serious issues. The other thing, frankly, is I think the balance question matters. I think state government is run by one party, one team on the field, one team only, and I think that leads to a lot of bad behavior and a lot of bad decision-making, and I think we'd be, you know, I'm the product of what I call a mixed marriage. You know, my mom's a Democrat, my dad's a Republican. And I grew up listening to the two of them argue about politics the whole time I was a kid. And it was a good thing. I came away believing that competition in ideas, competition in policy, competition in politics, just like competition in everything else, is a good thing. And we don't have that in Massachusetts.
Well, Charlie Baker, Republican nominee for governor of Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks for having me.
We'll be talking to all of the Massachusetts candidates for governor this week. Tomorrow, Governor Deval Patrick. And back to our top story, President Obama's nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. It's generating a lot of buzz in Boston's blogosphere today, and our reporter on the ground virtually is Andrew Phelps. Hey, Andrew.
Magna, lots of local Kagan talk on Twitter here in Boston. Trevor from Cambridge tweets, Elena Kagan picked by Obama today as the next Supreme Court justice. Really? Why not me? Like Kagan, I've never been a judge, and I've read about the law. Well, Alex Whalen in Boston says, it's odd to watch the people who praised Obama for being a law professor bash Kagan for the same thing. Isn't it more relevant here? Magna, some prominent Harvard scholars are jumping into the fray, blogging their support for a former colleague. We've got links on our new blog, Hubbub. Check it out at wbur.org/Boston.
Andrew Phelps, reporter for wbur.org. Thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Magna.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow at 3 for more Radio Boston.